During this retreat, in the evening talks, what I want to do is to go through the first three discourses of the Buddha, having at least a quick look at them, and just go through chronologically. They are very significant. The tradition regards them as being very important, and together they basically give the fundamental structure of the whole teaching. There's also a whole lot of interesting stories around them, and stories are nice. Usually I give dry academic Dharma talks. And so I thought if I do these three teachings, I can throw in bedtime stories as well. And they're very nice stories and very interesting stories. And you see something of the Buddha himself, his character as it develops, and his sense of himself and his mission as it develops. So they are quite interesting. They are Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, turning the Dharma wheel. Anattalakkhana Sutta, the characteristics of not-self. And Aditta Pariyaya Sutta, burning, or usually translated the fire sermon. So these are the three discourses that we'll go through during this retreat. And looking for a place to start, what we might start with is the awakening itself. Or in fact, we might just before then. As you know, the Buddha was awakened sitting under the Bodhi tree, which is located at the what is now the village of Bodh Gaya in southern Bihar state. And this in itself is interesting, given that when he left home and decided to take up the practice, he was living in what is now southern Nepal, in his home state of the Shakya Republic, at the age of 29. Something happens to him. His whole life is turned around. We'll have a look at that very soon. And he abandons home and he goes off in search of enlightenment. And where he goes is southeast. He goes first to the area around Visali, which I think is in what is now would be the eastern part of the state of Uttar Pradesh. And there he practices meditation under two teachers who are named, Alara Kamala and Uddaka Ramaputta. Then he goes further southeast and he ends up in the then Indian state of Magadha, which is roughly what is now South Bihar, so south of the Ganges River in the state of Bihar. And that's where he did his ascetic practices, and that's where he eventually became enlightened. Now, of course, the first question that pops up is, why did he go there? The area around Visali was known for its yoga traditions, and specifically meditation. So when Siddhartha left home, he had a fair idea of where he wanted to go. He wanted to go to where what we might call the Dharma culture was strongest, and that was to the southeast. So the area around Visali, roughly eastern part of Uttar Pradesh, and then further southeast in the Gaya area, where he went there. Now, Gaya was famous for two, or that area, that region, was famous in particular for two aspects. First of all, it was then and is today a very shamanically powerful part of India. It's the most haunted part of certainly North India. The spirits, the restless dead, are the most active and the most powerful in that area. And to this day, the area around Gaya is regarded as very psychically dangerous, very haunted. So the Buddha seeks out an area which is shamanically very powerful. Because Siddhartha, he wasn't the Buddha yet. This is before he's awakened. Siddhartha was a shaman. And his shamanic qualities come out every now and again. They've largely been forgotten by the tradition, or at least are kind of quietly not mentioned, but they're there. They come out in interesting ways. For example, the famous story about Sujata and the Bodhi tree. When Siddhartha, he's looking for a place to meditate, he finds a nice tree, a Bodhi tree, and he thinks, this is a nice tree, and he sits under it. And we're thinking, oh yeah, you know, it's probably a nice area, nice shade, not too many mozzies, river close by, good place to meditate. Then a young girl from a local village called Sujata comes along with an offering of food to give to the spirit of that tree. And she comes to the tree and she sees Siddhartha sitting there and she thinks, oh, he must be the spirit. So she gives him the food and heads off. So he gets a nice meal, which fattens him up for the enlightenment. And it's a very sweet story, and you know, you get modern interpretations like, you know, Siddhartha finds his feminine side via Sujata and so on and so forth. It's a very sweet story. But if you read the story from the perspective of the culture at the time, spirits are very territorial. It's like when we, in our culture, if you're haunted by a ghost, ghosts haunt places. They're very territorial. You step outside the house and it ain't haunted. You step inside and it is. And spirits in ancient India had a very strict sense of territoriality. So, for example, a spirit might inhabit a cave or a particular graveyard, but always very specific localities. And they were very possessive about their territory, and you did not intrude on that territory without permission, especially if they were powerful and liable to anger. You see it also in indigenous cultures. I used to did some meditation in a little town in Tasmania, and outside the town there's a nice walk to a cave. And one time one of the meditators was a guy who'd spent a lot of time in Central Australia and had studied with shamans, men of high degree. And after he came back from a walk from that cave, and he said, "There's a very powerful serpent spirit lives in that cave, and you should not approach it without announcing yourself." And I said, "How do I do that?" And there was there's a stream coming through it, through the mouth of it. And before you get to the cave, there's a place where you've got to step over the stream. And he said, it would be polite, before you stepped over that stream, to pick up some stones and toss them into the stream to announce your coming. It's like knocking on the door. And then you can enter. But otherwise, it'd be you'd offend the spirit, and the spirit would get angry. And it could be pretty bad. So here is Siddhartha. Finds a nice tree. A nice tree? This is a haunted tree. This is a very powerful spirit that lives in that tree. He then marches straight in and sits down. Right, I think I'll sit here. Can you imagine sitting down in your living room, calmly doing whatever you do in your living room, suddenly the door flings open, some bloke strides in, looks around and says, yep, this looks nice to me. Sits down. What are you doing here? Bugger off. It's not very nice. But that's what he did. He wasn't content with that. He then steals the guy's lunch. Which is really asking for a fight and really slapping the spirit around. Now, this is what was happening. This is a young man full of fight, looking for a fight. And of course he got one with Mara and the 10 armies. And we often see Siddhartha there as being, you know, the purely innocent party, and he's this crazy Mara on a war of aggression. But maybe Siddhartha actually was looking for it. Maybe he wanted a bit of a biffo. He seemed to have that kind of character, which will perhaps come out further in our talk. So he sits under the Bodhi tree, very powerful place, and he makes the breakthrough. He becomes awakened. He becomes the Buddha. He spent the first week sitting under the tree. The text says, for 7 days in one session, feeling the bliss of deliverance. So something happens. He wakes up and he's completely out of it for a week. he emerges from that samadhi, pretty shell-shocked, one would imagine. And then what he does is he contemplates paticca samuppada, dependent arising. And the text, which is the Mahakandaka, it's one of the books in the Vinaya Pitaka. The Vinaya is the section of teachings relating to monastic discipline. So lay people generally don't read it. But the Mahakandaka is the earliest history of the formation of the monastic sangha and therefore of Buddhism. So it's probably the earliest layer of stories about the foundation of Buddhism itself. So the text says that he contemplated dependent arising during the night in forward order, reverse order, and in forward and reverse order. In other words, he reviews intellectually what he has realized. He realizes something. He wakes up. And it blows him out of the water for a week, basically before he comes to. What was that all about? And then he immediately goes back to the experience and starts reviewing it and creating a conceptual framework so he can make sense of what just happened. And this is very significant, and it's quite typical of him. He's a shaman, very powerful, but he's also got this very strong rational side to him. He's a philosopher and a psychologist, as well as a shaman. So it's not enough to have a powerful experience. What we need to do is to know what it means. We have to learn to read it in some way. And this is really fundamental in the Buddhist tradition. When we meditate, we don't just collect interesting experiences. Well, some people would like to collect interesting experiences because the experiences they have are generally pretty mundane. But sometimes people have, quite spectacular experiences. Sometimes you don't even need to meditate to have a spectacular experience. A bit of help from substance might assist. But also quite spontaneously, particularly in adolescence, people can stumble into deep experiences where they have no business being, really. But the question is, what does it mean? And this is a fundamental question. It can mean, oh my God, I've just gone mad. It could mean, oh, that was nice. 30 years later, when I'm a successful finance advisor entertaining my yuppie friends over a nice glass of wine, I can tell them about the story that what happened to me on the beach back when I was 18 years old. And they can be amused by it. So it can be just weird, be meaningless, and therefore have no influence on one's life. Or it could be a profound turnaround of one's whole way of life. It depends on what it means. And that means putting a framework on it, examining the experience and seeing what is going on, how does it work, what does it mean, what's its significance. And of course, when we do insight meditation, that's what we are doing. We are not simply becoming intimate with experience, although we are, but we're also questioning, what does it mean? What's the significance of this? And a lot of the teaching that we hear when we undergo meditation training is about learning to read our experience, to make sense of it. And that's what the Buddha immediately begins to do. We'll talk about dependent arising later on. In the second week, the Buddha moves to the Ajapala Nigrodha tree, where he's again sat for 7 days in one session, feeling the bliss of deliverance. So he comes out of it. So he moves to another tree in the area, sits there for 7 days, comes out of it, and then he meets a Brahmin. And this, I think, is the first time that's recorded after his enlightenment that he actually talks to someone. And it's interesting that it's a Brahmin or a Brahmana in Pali. And it's the brief conversation in which the Buddha, this Brahmana is very proud, very arrogant, and the Buddha speaks to him about the true nature of a Brahmana. Now, the Brahmanas were, in the Buddha's time in India, the what we would call the spiritual or religious practitioners could be divided into two broad categories. There was the Brahmanas, these are the hereditary Vedic priesthood, and the Samanas, these are everybody else. And Samanas are very diverse. Well, both of them, both categories are very diverse. So a lot of Brahmanas would not be spiritual at all. They would just they would be scholars, they might be landowners, or whatever. But they, as then as today, believed that they were had a special revelation, and that the Vedas, the knowledge, belonged to them, and that therefore they had a special status within society. The Buddha always fought against this idea. And what he objected to was the idea that you could claim a special status, purely a special spiritual status, purely on the basis of your birth, rather than on the basis of what you did, of how you lived. And for him, it's all about how you live. So he's talking in his first teaching, and this is not counted as the first discourse. What he teaches, what he talks about is not his awakening. What he talks about is ethics, how one should live a civilized life. So this preoccupation with ethics is again typical of him, and he comes back to it again and again throughout his career. But at this point, he's not making any attempt to tell anybody about his awakening. He's not trying to communicate it to anybody else. So at the moment, it's too big. It's too much to communicate. In the third week, the Buddha moves to the Mucchalinda tree, where he again stays for 7 days. Now, the Mucchalinda tree is named after Mucchalinda, who is a Naga Raja, a royal Naga. A Naga is a snake, but also a spirit, a serpent spirit. The Nagas are spirits of particularly associated with earth, water, and fire. Not so much air. And in fact, their enemies are the Garuda. The Garuda are the giant birds, and they attack Nagas who live on the ground, under the ground, or underwater. So they're earth and water spirits in particular. But we shall see later on, they also have a connection with fire. Nagas are known for their treasure underneath the ground, underneath the water. They guard great treasures. And they're known for wisdom. And they're also known for their shape-shifting abilities. They're tricksters as well. So Nagas can appear as human beings and in different shapes and forms. Now, again, the Buddha has just barged into a powerful spirit's territory. But such is his power, particularly now that he's awakened, that the spirit, Mucchalinda, makes way for him. And it's said that as the Buddha was sitting there, there was a big storm, lots of rain, and the Naga wrapped his body around the Buddha and made a hood with his 7 heads and protected the Buddha from the elements. And of course, we've probably all seen those statues where the Buddha's sitting and surrounded by the coils of a Naga. This is Mucchalinda, the Naga Raja. And again, it's the Buddha as shaman which comes out. This is a man who can pacify the most powerful spirits without any particular bother. After the storm, the Naga unwraps himself and they have a nice little conversation. But again, there's no attempt on the part of the Buddha to explain his enlightenment. The Naga expresses his faith, his saddha, in this great ascetic, this great shaman. But that it's about faith rather than wisdom. So again, there's no attempt to communicate the awakening. The Buddha moves to the Rajayatana tree for 7 days, where again he sits for one session, feeling the bliss of deliverance. At the end of this, he meets the two merchants, Tapusa and Baluka, who become the first lay followers of the Buddha. These two are particularly important. Well, they're probably important all over the place, but in Burma they are particularly revered because as the first lay followers, it's obvious to the Burmese that they were, in fact, Burmese. And they were merchants trading in India, and they happened to be on their way back to Burma when they bumped into the Buddha, and they brought Buddhism back to Burma, and that's why Burmese Buddhism is number one. At least if you're Burmese. I don't know if they have a relationship to other Theravada countries as well. I wouldn't be surprised. And then the next week, the Buddha moves back to the Ajapala Nigrodha tree, and there, and this is in the fifth week, there he begins to seriously come to terms with what has happened to him. And this is what he is recorded as thinking. He says, "This Dharma which I have discovered is deep, difficult to understand, difficult to awaken to, peaceful, exalted, beyond reason, subtle, experienced only by the wise. But this people finds pleasure in attachment, is intent on attachment, delights in attachment. And for a people that finds pleasure in attachment, is intent on attachment, and delights in attachment, this condition is difficult to see, specific conditionality dependent arising. And this condition is extremely difficult to see, calming all formations, letting go of all supports, craving exhausted, obsession fading, cessation nibbana." So, I'll just go through this little description. The Buddha talks about what it is that he's realized. And what he's talking about, first of all, he talks about how difficult this is to understand. "This Dharma which I have discovered is deep, difficult to understand, difficult to awaken to, peaceful, exalted, beyond reason, subtle, experienced only by the wise." This is not something for everyone. He makes it quite clear. And then he goes on, "But this people finds pleasure in attachment," etc., etc. Ordinary people, us, we find pleasure in attachment, in our various attachments. Quite a nice evening, don't you think? Don't you get pleasure from that? Wouldn't it be bad if it wasn't a nice evening? If somehow this nice evening was lost, maybe the timber cutters came first, followed by the suburb builders. And for people like us who have attachment to this sort of thing, this Dharma is difficult to understand. Who is mad enough not to have attachment to that sort of thing? So, as he's saying, for the human condition, this is extremely difficult to figure out. And then he talks about what it is that he's awakened to in two themes. This condition is difficult to see, specific conditionality dependent arising. Again, dependent arising, paticca sammuppada. Now, dependent arising is the basic framework of the Buddha. It's what sets him apart from all other teachers. Dependent arising is basically saying that whatever we experience is caused by something other than itself. Whatever we experience comes into existence because of something other than itself, and it ends because of something other than itself. That's the basic principle. Whatever happens begins because of something else and ends because of something else. In other words, the experience world is an infinite network of conditional relationships in which nothing is stable, in which there is no underlying fundamental principle or reality or something. It's just an infinite ocean of conditions surging against each other, and nothing underneath it, nothing else, just that. It's a very radical view of the nature of the world. And it's a view of the world which we instinctively reject. So I can reasonably see that the world is an infinite network of cause and effect conditions which results in this particular ecology that we have here. For most of us, up until this generation, we would have thought that something like, for example, the climate was pretty much permanent, that it's just there. In our generation, we've discovered that it isn't just there, that in fact it's a complex system which depends on a multitude of causes and effects, that you can interfere with it, that in fact we have interfered with it, and therefore it's changing into something else. It has no stability. Just recently there's been a few stories about how the proportion of people, certainly in the Western world, who are more inclined to deny climate change is growing. Interestingly, not just among the old, although there was a recent article pointed by George Monbiot, I think he's, I'm not quite sure how he pronounces his name, but an English commentator who said that particularly older people seem to have problems with this. But it's really weird that it's happening among young people. Apparently in New South Wales, young liberals, climate denialism is very fashionable. It's quite taken off. And it's quite interesting when you see climate change denialism. It's like, where is it coming from? Apparently, it's not coming from the science. I wouldn't know. I'm not a climate scientist. But any information that I get that actually comes from the scientists say that we are seriously challenged in a stream of fecal matter in a vehicle which lacks propulsion. So I take their word for it. Yet a lot of people seem determined, a lot of people who don't know anything about, who know less about science maybe than I do, are determined that the experts are wrong. But they have no basis, rational basis for it. So presumably it's an emotional response. Perhaps it's the horror of the recognition that we're living in a world which really is that fragile, which really is that dependent upon a multitude of conditions. Could that really be true? No. It's too horrifying. So dependent arising as a principle, as a basic principle, from a Buddhist point of view, climate change is, yeah, of course, obviously. It's just a system. It's dependent upon conditions. Change of the conditions, it changes systems. What's the big deal? It's obvious. But if you're not used to that framework, it must be a profound existential shock that something that one takes for granted as permanent, as stable, as always being available, suddenly turns out to be not so. So this is just one example of how instinctively we do not see the world in terms of dependent arising. So you get a sense of the radicality of the Buddha when he realized that this is the nature of the world. Everything is like this. So he talks about dependent arising. That's the general principle. And specific conditionality, iddhapaccayattha. This is the general principle applied to the specifics. So right now, this experience right now is dependent upon that. It becomes very specific. So let's say you're sitting in meditation and you move. Why do you move? Something happened. Something quite specific. A pain, an irritation arose somewhere in the body. A response to that arose somewhere in the mind. And that response said, move, and we moved. And we may not have even noticed that we moved until after we've moved. We were just pushed in a certain direction, quite literally. Boom, move. by something very specific. If that very specific experience had not occurred, we would not have moved. So the specific conditionality is taking this general principle and bringing it right down to the specifics of exactly what's moving me right now. So this, and this whole area, dependent arising specific conditionality, is broadly what the Buddha would come to call vipassana, insight, or panya, wisdom. This is the understanding aspect of the Buddha's awakening. And then the Buddha goes on, he says, and this condition is extremely difficult to see, calming all formations, letting go of all supports, craving exhausted, obsession faded, cessation, nibbana. Now here he's talking about what he later came to call samatha, serenity. The calming of formations. Formations is another technical term, which essentially, and we'll talk about it more as we go through the retreat, essentially points out that anything that exists is made up of parts. So anything that's made up of parts is a formation. It's formed by things. So this building is a formation. It's formed by different materials that are put together in a certain way. This retreat is a formation. It's social formation, biological formation, because we've got a particular bunch of people who have turned up in this room in this evening to listen to this talk. This is a social construction. It's very complex. Think of the numbers of decisions that had to be made by the numbers of people to get this particular group of people sitting in this particular hall now. All of us went through a whole series of decisions to get here, and those decisions were based on life histories that go back for decades, if not for centuries. So this situation is immensely complex in the way that it's constructed. This is formations. And the Buddha is talking here about the calming of all formations, just everything settling down. Letting go of all supports. We won't go into this, it gets too technical. But you get a sense of the letting go of supports. I don't need anything to prop me up. I can just let it go. Let that one go. Just let it go. Craving exhausted. Craving is drivenness, out of control, disordered desire and aversion. Craving represents the disordered heart and the drive, the sense of drivenness that characterizes it. And this becomes exhausted. It just winds down. Obsession faded. Cessation, nibbana. So this represents the calming, the cooling of the heart. The first bit represents understanding, wisdom, what is actually going on. The second bit represents the calming, the cooling of the heart, the discovery of a deep serenity in the midst of all this change, of all this chaos. So the first one is vipassana, insight. The second aspect is samatha, serenity. These are the two aspects that the Buddha lays out, and he points out the first one is hard enough, understanding. The second one is even harder, which is quite interesting. What we're doing is what is popularly known as insight meditation. Of course, one can do serenity meditation. Probably some people in this room have. But when the Buddha talks about insight and serenity, he doesn't talk about it in terms of techniques. He doesn't really talk about it in terms of meditations. He talks about it in terms of qualities of the heart and of the mind. And for him, it's hard enough to get a clear view of what's going on. It's even harder to calm the heart. But a precondition for calming the heart is to actually know what's going on. So his the general direction of his teaching is first see what's going on, get to know what's going on clearly, see it clearly, and then the heart can start to calm down. And The second one is actually harder. It's if you hang around the meditation scene long enough, you get to know people who seem to have a fair bit of understanding. So you talk to them and they've definitely got a fair bit of understanding. It's rarer to find people who just radiate a natural, ordinary, everyday serenity. These people are rarer. It seems to be harder to get there. So the Buddha is saying, this is really, really hard. This is incredibly difficult. And as a result, he decides he will not teach. Now, this is the first time the Buddha's thought about the possibility of actually teaching this stuff. And as soon as he thinks about it, he thinks, no way, Jose, this is far too difficult, and I ain't going to do it. So the reluctance of the Buddha to teach, which is quite strange, given our image of the Buddha as being supremely compassionate, etc., etc. Fortunately for us, a certain Deva, Brahma Sahampati, was eavesdropping on his mind. Brahma Sahampati is a deity who lives in a particularly refined heaven, from which, when he passes away, he will be, or in which he will become fully enlightened, and then he will just disappear completely. He was a student of the previous Buddha, who had attained the third stage of awakening, got reborn in this heaven realm, had a professional interest in the re-emergence of Buddhism, when a new Buddha pops up, and is kind of having a look, checking out, and is horrified that this new Buddha, the new kid on the block, has decided not to teach. So he rockets down to earth and he says, you've got to teach. And the argument that he gives is that there are a few people with just a little bit of dust. If you teach them, they will understand. But if you don't, they will perish. And the Buddha is convinced by this argument and he decides to teach. So one thing which becomes apparent from this story is that the Buddha himself never thought that he was going to create a mass movement. He didn't seem to have any notion that this was going to become big. He thought, okay, a few people, maybe. But no more than that. But why was the Buddha so unwilling to teach? Granted, yes, very difficult, but why would he shirk the challenge? Why would he hesitate? And perhaps we can, if we look at his character, the way he came to his enlightenment, we might begin to get a sense of what was going on. Let's backtrack to before the Buddha became the Buddha, when he was just Siddhartha Gautama. Siddhartha was his first name, Gautama his family name. He was born a Raja. Raja does not mean prince, does not mean king. Usually the stories say that he was a prince, the son of a king, but this is anachronistic. He was born into one of the old tribal republics. His father was probably the leading citizen of the republic, the Shakya Republic, but it was a republic. And these republics, they weren't democracies in our sense. The members of the aristocracy, through their birth, had the right of membership of the Parissa, the assembly. And in the assembly, which is the centre of communal life, that would be their parliament as well as their community centre, and they would discuss all the problems of community life and come to decisions. So they were democratic within the assembly. But of course, they didn't have elections to be members of the assembly. You were born into it, if you remember the aristocracy. And Siddhartha was born into that aristocracy. His father was apparently the chief citizen of the Shakya Republic. And it's quite reasonable to suppose that this position was hereditary, that Siddhartha would have inherited the job. So Siddhartha was raised in a tribal republic, part of the ruling elite, and being groomed to take over his father's job of leading the republic later on. Everything seemed to be going well for the young man until The story says that Siddhartha one day saw aging, sickness, and death for the first time. He suddenly realized that everybody gets old, everybody gets sick, and everybody dies. And he was, according to the tradition, he was 29 when he figured it out. To which the most reasonable response to this discovery might be, duh. It took you until you were 29 to figure that out. Where have you been? And in fact, later tradition invents all these stories about how he was incredibly pampered and sheltered and so on to explain this. But we don't have need to go into those kinds of stories, because what this story is talking about is how, as a young man, he saw, as if for the first time, the normal, everyday suffering that we all of us take for granted as being part of life. But the important thing is to see it as if for the first time. The initial awakening is the capacity to be shocked by life as it is, without any of the normal human defences that we put up, and we learn to put up from a very young age. So we accept death. We know that death is real. But of course we avoid it as much as possible. And we worship youth, we pursue our immortality projects, we pretend it's not going to happen. We know it's going to happen. It's kind of buried back there. But we pretend it's not. We accept the inevitability of sickness, but we get angry if the government doesn't provide us with the best hospitals. We accept ageing, but we have a multi-billion dollar industry that is designed to slow it down. And even those of us who don't buy into that, every day we look at the mirror and we get a bit more alarmed after a certain age at what we see there. So, but we turn away from the mirror as soon as possible and we get on with it. And this, of course, would have been what Siddhartha's family would have said to him. Well, get on with it. Of course, life sucks. Okay, great, true. But life is, this is it. This is what life is all about. And you've got a job to do. And you can do a lot of good in your life. What are you doing moping around all the time? Get over it. But Siddhartha was in this strange existential condition in which he recognizes as a crisis what everybody else sees as the obvious, the everyday, that which must be endured. Everybody else has made their peace with this. You have to make your peace with it if you're to live a sane, meaningful life. But Siddhartha can't. Once he gets this flash, something happened. And he was open, he was vulnerable, and it hit him. And he could not accept it. He could not make his peace with this. Which meant, as soon as that happened, he was in radical conflict with his society, with his family, and in particular with his father. He was way out of sync with them, and he was in radical conflict because he could not accept what they were saying life should be like. Now, Siddhartha is in conflict with the world, and of course, and this is what characterizes this conflict, he's utterly, completely unwilling to compromise. He will not compromise one iota. And the result is a scandal. It was a scandal then, and it's a scandal today. Feminists today find it difficult to forgive the fact that this bloke walks out on his wife and his child. Sorry, dear, I've got to go and get enlightened. I'm out of here. Which is what he did. Now, his story has it that he walked out at the very day that his son was born. He went to the room where his wife and infant son were sleeping, and he had never actually held his son, and he wanted to reach down and lift him up and hold him. But he was too afraid to, because he thought, if I do, I won't leave. Particularly if his wife wakes up and would plead for him to stay. And he thought, I can't do this. So he just sneaks out of the palace at night, like a thief, and disappears. It's a scandal. It's absolutely unacceptable. But this is Siddhartha. He will not compromise. So off he goes. So he's a very, very stubborn individual. And the other thing which comes out, once he leaves home and he heads southeast and starts his practice, his career as a Dharma student, is that he's got a very strong competitive streak. This comes out in his relationships with his two teachers, his two named teachers. We don't know, there might have been others, but these two are named. Alara Kamala and Uddaka Ramaputta. So he comes, he meets Alara Kamala, famous meditation teacher, lots of students, big ashram, the whole box and dice. And decides, I'll stay here and do the training. But this is what he thinks about it. This is from a discourse, a later discourse. He's telling his students, he's reminiscing about his past to his current students. He says, I considered, not only Alara Kamala has faith, energy, mindfulness, unification and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, unification and wisdom. These are the five indriyas, the five leading faculties, which we must cultivate in order to get enlightened. In other words, what Siddhartha is saying is, I am at least as good as he is. If he can do it, I can do it, and I can do it better. There's an element of competitiveness here. I resonate with it because if I look back and ask myself, what was the first sign to myself that I wanted to become a Dharma teacher? Was it that I felt I have to save the world? Well, actually, no. It was sitting like you are, listening to a Dharma talk, thinking, I could give a better Dharma talk than that.
Yeah.
And that's what started me off. Competition. Ego. And I could see it here in Siddhartha. I could do that. I could do it better. So he does. And he charges into the practice and he completes the whole thing in quick time. First he does the study, then he does the practice. Alara Kamala is so impressed that he offers Siddhartha the leadership. Come up, sit beside me, we'll teach this mob of useless glongos together. And what is Siddhartha's response? He walks out. He doesn't want a bar of it. The tradition does not record him even saying goodbye. There's no record of him saying thanks. It's just, nah, I'm out of here. Boom. You's lot are not good enough for me. I'm gone. So off he goes. So he's in conflict with his own teacher. Just walks out on him. Just like he walked out on his father. He goes to the next teacher, Uddaka Ramaputta. Exactly the same thing happens. Exactly the same thing. We are seeing a pattern here. We are seeing someone, a practitioner, who thinks that no one and nothing is good enough for him. We are seeing someone driven on his quest for enlightenment in a quest which is essentially solitary. He doesn't want any companion. He especially doesn't want any rival. He spends time in a community. He takes what he can get from them, and it apparently doesn't even occur to him that he could give anything back. He just sucks what they've got and walks out because they're not good enough for him. After his meditation phase, then he moves further southeast to the Gaya area and he begins ascetic practices. Gaya was also famous for its ascetic practices. The Jains were quite strong there, and different sects that were also followed asceticism. Asceticism we'll talk about more about later on, but they're essentially seeking enlightenment through self-inflicted pain, seeking to overcome dukkha, pain, by cultivating pain. And again, it's not just confined to India. You see these traditions around the world. Five companions join him on this quest, but he's not their teacher. They're just kind of hanging around. It's a strange community which is not a community. They don't seem to have much of a social bond. The relationship between them is more like competitors in the same race. So they're together, but they're not really helping each other. It's more like who's going to get there first. And the favourite is Siddhartha. Everybody thinks he's going to get there first. But there's this deeply competitive ethos that seems in the tradition itself. It's not just Siddhartha, it's others as well. So these are all blokes, of course, deeply competitive, determined to get to enlightenment, struggling to get there first and to have the biggest enlightenment. I came across this attitude when I was in Burma, practicing at Mahasi Center. After Sayadaw Upandita, who was my main teacher, became famous, famous, because he went to the US of A and became well known. And suddenly, at the Mahasi Center, all these foreigners turned up, and lots of Americans. And they were quite competitive. The schedule was very difficult. This is a kindergarten playtime summer holiday camp, in comparison. At Mahasi Center, wake up is at 3 a.m., walking meditation from 3 to 4. The meditation hall opens at 4. Only two meals a day, of course. Your eating is all finished by about 10:30 a.m. Sit walk until I think 8 to 9 is the last sitting period. The hall closes at 9. 9 to 10 is walking meditation outside, and 10 to 11 is sitting meditation in your room. And lights out at 11, get up at 3 and do the same thing. So sleep 4 hours. Why 4 hours? Buddha slept 4 hours. If it's good enough for Buddha, it's good enough for you. So it was pretty tough. But when the Upandita gathered all these fanatical students from around the world, it got really bizarre. And this race developed. And you get these strange whispered conversations. How many hours are you sleeping? 4. I'm sleeping 3. It's bizarre. You can, particularly with, I don't know if about women, but particularly with blokes, you can get this really competitive subculture going, where I'm going to get there first and I'm going to leave you behind in the dust, and you are really going to know about it. So it seems in the Buddha's time, the same thing was happening, and Siddhartha was really caught up with it. So this is the kind of character that he was. He's in competition, not just with his companions, but it seems with his ideal others. Again, in a later discourse, he says, look, thinking back at this time, he says, I thought whatever samanas or brahmanas in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings because of exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever samanas or brahmanas in the future will experience painful, racking, piercing feelings because of exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever samanas or brahmanas in the present experience painful, racking, piercing feelings because of exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. In other words, he won. Anybody in the past who has done these practices, I've beaten them. Anyone in the future who will do them, I've beaten them. Anyone in the present who is doing them, I've beaten them. His specialty was self-starvation. He almost killed himself. So he's driven, competitive, stubborn, not listening to anyone, incapable of actually being taught, and drives himself to the point of death before he finally realizes it ain't working. And when he does realize it, what is the realization that hits him? But I have not attained any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, from this racking practice of austerities. Could there be another path to awakening? Doubt finally creeps in, but it creeps in because when he realizes he's won the race, but no one's applauding. He's made it. He's done more than anybody has ever done or will ever do. But his imagined ideal others, the noble ones, the cultivated ones, these would not consider that what he's attained is worth it. I have not attained any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. He's won the race and no one's applauding. So what's the point? And it's here that he realizes that he's been on the wrong track and he's got to rethink the whole enterprise. So, after he does that and he becomes the Buddha, he's awakened, he then thinks, he's reflecting how difficult it is, the subtlety, the difficulty of understanding what he has understood. He then thinks of teaching someone. Could it be that he was reluctant to teach because he was horrified at the idea of teaching someone like him? Because who would he teach? He would teach his own younger self. Who would be in a position to listen to him? The people who are just like him. That elite of ascetic athletes, that subculture from which he emerged. And maybe he thought, I was so difficult to get through to. I was so determined not to listen to anyone. And now I've got to... How could anybody have connected with me? And now I've got to do it? I've got to go to these people and teach them and get through to them? I think maybe that's why he was reluctant to teach. If you consider his conflicted relationship with his family, his conflicted relationship with his teachers, his stubbornness in pursuing the dead end of asceticism to the point that it almost killed him, did he think of how difficult he was to teach? And so if he's going to find a way that he can communicate what he's experienced, he's really got to work at finding something, some way to break through to people just like him, to communicate what he's experienced, to get them out of the rut that they're in and looking at things in a completely new light, in a completely different way, in a way that he, his younger self, would never have imagined. How would he do it? How would he go about doing it? Well, this is the project that he undertook when he taught the first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, turning the Dharma wheel. So tomorrow we're going to have a look at that discourse and we're going to see what he did to make that breakthrough. What was the strategy that he came up with to cut through to people just like him and to communicate something completely new to them? And that's enough for tonight. Thank you.